From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A little more than a century ago, Jewish people around the world faced decisions that have proved critical in shaping the past century. Today, we're going to look at some of those decisions through the eyes of two historians who are launching a lecture series in January at the Temple of Israel's Reibman Center in Wilmington. Joining us now is Carol Fink, a former faculty member at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and a retired history professor of The Ohio State University. Carol Fink, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
And with us today, Glenn Tedderton, who has taught history and German in the New Hanover County High School system, two high schools, New Hanover and Ashley, and has collaborated with Professor Fink in the past on Jewish history. Glenn Tedderton, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about Jewish history, call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. The focus of this joint lecture series that you're launching in January really takes a look at that period from the late 19th to early 20th century. Why this period? Why is that worth pulling back the curtain on, Carol Fink?
Well, this is the time just before the First World War when you have a generation of Jews who are facing modernity. There's been almost a century in which emancipation has taken place in America and in large parts of Europe. Life is changing very dramatically. People are moving from countryside to city. They're even changing continents. Speed of movement, communication, industries, all sorts of changes are happening. Another change that's, of course, less welcome to this minority is the outbreak of anti-Semitism in the 1880s.
And where did that first start appearing?
Well, modern anti-Semitism is, of all places, born in France. And it's born with the writing of a man named Edward Drumont, who wrote a book called Jewish France, in which he said, in the old days, we knew that Jews were living as a separate people. They lived in a ghetto. Now they're out of the ghettos. They're dressed just like we are. They live just like we are. They're in our courts, our schools, our armies. But they still don't belong because there is a racial difference. Modern anti-Semitism posited an ineluctable division among people. And then it spreads to Germany and to Russia and to other parts of the world, including the United States. So at the very same time, the Jews are trying to decide how they're going to deal with this confusing, challenging, wonderful modern world. They're also facing this barrier.
Glenn Tedderton, why did anti-Semitism catch on and move around the world that way? What was happening in the collective consciousness at that time that caused this to hit a nerve?
Well, the economy was changing a great deal, and it was creating a lot of stress for many people. Industrialization didn't hit every place at the same time. Or in the same way. So many people lost traditional ways of living, or they lost the farm. They had to go to the city. It was difficult for many people. And it's also a time when newspapers were becoming widely read, and some journalists were, I would say, trying to sell papers any way they could. And there was a growing sense of identity as a member of a nation, whether it's Czech nation, which didn't really exist as a separate country yet, or a German or French. And so part of that decision about being a part of a nation meant who's inside and who's outside.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring Jewish history in the early part of the 20th century with Glenn Tedderton and Carol Fink, two distinguished historians. And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You've called this series Tevye's Daughters. And of course, that's a
That's an allusion to the classic musical Fiddler on the Roof, which is based on the story by Shalom Aleichem, Tevye's daughters. So who are Tevye's daughters, and why are they important in your lecture series, these fictional people? What do they have to do with reality?
Well,
Carol Fink.
The three oldest daughters, of course, make very significant choices. One marries the village tailor and will live, we now know, a very traditional life.
Except, and that's Seidel?
Seidel. And it will be buffeted, of course, by the pogrom that come along. The second daughter, who is Chodel, you know, marries the revolutionary, the man who's going to overturn the Tsarist Empire and bring social justice. And she leaves home and family and follows him. And the third, who makes probably the most agonizing choice of all, this is Chava, marries a Russian and converts, basically is married in a Christian church. Now, of course, these are, of course, very, very difficult choices for them and for their family. And we made these the emblems, in a way, of how we are going to deal with this question in our lecture. The first part is going to deal with religious choices. The second with people who look outside to work for social justice. And the third, people who look at a national or an international kind of way of living as the decision they want to make in their lives.
So let's take a look then at Seidel, or at I guess her the spiritual choices that of which she would be emblematic. It was the early part of the 20th century when Hasidism, Orthodoxy, did this. Was this the reemergence of it, Glenn Tetterton?
Well, just as everybody else was experiencing stresses, the Hasidic movements, and there's more than one movement. There are many Hasidic movements, and the other Orthodox who were not Hasidic were all having to make adjustments. So we'll talk about that as well as the forms of progressive Judaism that are emerging during this time. Reform has already emerged as a movement for quite a while, and it's this time that conservative Judaism begins to take shape and establish institutions. So in all forms of Judaism, there are some adaptations. There are changes.
And Hasidism, for instance, why? That's often described as a mystical form of Judaism. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, there's mystic aspects in all branches of Judaism. I would say Hasidism does have a great emphasis on that, more than traditional non-Hasidic orthodoxy. But it's not limited in that way. Mostly the divisions within Judaism are about how you practice Judaism. So it's not so much that beliefs can be very different, but really how you approach living it.
And what are some of those differences in the different, just taking a look at Hasidism?
Well, the Hasidim started out as kind of a joyful, ecstatic movement. It rejected traditional orthodoxy with its emphasis on Talmudic study and Torah study, although they began to reappropriate that, and they have great study centers now. But they started out for ordinary people who didn't have the access to the scholarly knowledge. And I would say Hasidism in the 19th century was, while there were women involved, it was really something for the boys. It was for the men. And women were not, well, Hasidim would go to their Rebbe and leave their family and go, you know, to another place to spend a holiday with them. And so the wife and the children were left at home alone. It's kind of a stressful thing for some people who grew up in Hasidic households. But I think it's developed more so that Hasidic women today also have a part in it.
And the father of, and I'm not going to get, but Rashab.
Oh, Baal Shem Tov?
Yes.
He lived in the early 19th century. I will talk about the Rashab, who was one of the Rebbe of the Chabad movement. That's one of the Hasidic movements.
Right.
He made some very important changes besides writing books on Jewish mysticism. He made some important institutional changes in how to maintain the Chabad movement.
And was there not a woman who was sort of a bright light in that early on? Or
there are always women involved, but you can't really have institutions if you don't have the support of the women.
Carol Finke, is this something of a contradiction, in a sense, of the men being the religious scholars early on, and yet there were some women who were so important in the early part of the 20th century in terms of, I guess, being social reformers in a way?
Oh, women were extremely active. They were extremely active in all three things we're going to talk about. You know, in religious reform, but also in social justice movements.
So how did women wind up getting pushed out of the religious scholar part of the equation?
Well, it's part of traditional Judaism, you know, that of the separation of duties, of the separation of status within the religion. The big change came with reform. And Reform Judaism, which starts in Germany and comes to the United States, and that is an egalitarian religion. You know, here you have women going up to the bima; they can read, they are fully members of the congregation. Now, of course, they didn't become rabbis until very recently, but its point has always been equality.
And we're going to come back to that, some of the female social reformers, when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a look at Jewish history through the lens of the late 19th and early 20th century. With us are two distinguished historians, Carol Finke and Glenn Tedderton. If you have a question for our guests, you can call us this Thursday at 910-343-1138. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're exploring the impact of decisions made by Jewish people around the world in the early part of the 20th century and how those decisions continue to affect us today. With us to answer your questions, former faculty member at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and retired history professor of The Ohio State University, Carol Finke. Also with us, former history and German teacher, Glenn Tedderton. The two are launching a lecture series in January at the Temple of Israel called Tevye's Daughters. And if you'd like to ask our historians a question about late 19th, early 20th century Jewish history, give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we do have a question from Gareth Evans at the Bellamy Mansion, which we'll get to in a second. But first, Carol Finke, before we went to break, you were talking about some of the female social reformers in the early part of the 20th century. Rosa Luxemburg is one of those people.
Rosa Luxemburg is a major figure in the late 19th and early 20th century. She was a brilliant theoretician, an important speaker. She was a prominent activist who opposed the First World War and ended up in prison because of that. She also stood up to Lenin, who called her an infantile left-winger, because she reminded Lenin that they needed to have an election, which he had canceled.
And yet when she died, he mourned her death, did he not?
Well, maybe. She was murdered. She was murdered in the very early stages of the German Revolution in January of 1919, and her death place in a canal in Berlin is still a shrine to many people, because what she represented was democratic socialism. She also represented, and I must say she's one of the people I greatly admire, when faced with the choices that people had to face in the late 19th century of who goes first or who's in and who's out.
What do you mean by that?
Men before women, Germans before Jews, Germans before Poles. Rose's answer was, we just widen the door and everybody walks in together. And that was her vision. And that's a vision that still survives in some people who believe in this kind of solidarity. She understood the power of nationalism. as well as religion. She was, after all, a Pole, and she realized the suffering of her people under the Tsarist Empire. On the other hand, her point was that liberation would come if we all walked through that door together.
Gareth Evans of the Bellamy Mansion writes, talk about the various strands of how Judaism impacted Wilmington society historically. And we'll toss that to you, Glenn Tetterton.
Well, Wilmington was a small community, but we did have an active congregation at the Temple of Israel, and B'nai Israel was founded during this time. We had a rabbi who was with us for 46 years, Samuel Mendelssohn. He was a brilliant scholar. He wrote a book in 1891 that is still in print today. I have the 2016 edition with me. It has an incredibly long title, The Criminal Jewish Prudence of the Ancient Hebrews, compiled from the Talmud and other rabbinical writings and compared with Roman and English penal Jewish prudence, which is hard to say.
That's a mouthful. Yeah.
It is, isn't it? It's still used in law schools throughout the English-speaking world, so it's impressive that we have someone from here who wrote a book in 1891 that's still in print.
And where did you get that book? Is that hard to find, or?
We went on the internet and found it and ordered it.
Longest book title in the
History of the world.
Yes.
He was a brilliant scholar in many ways. He did some other wonderful things. He adjudicated a case between Ephraim and Manasseh, which is Mr. X and Mr. Y. One of them had lent money to the other to get a ticket to come to America, and he gave them the money in rubles. Well, in the meantime, the revolution occurred, the ruble dropped in value, and should Ephraim pay Manasseh back the amount that he'd borrowed, or should he pay him back the amount that he was worth? An American lawyer said he should pay back what current ruble is worth, which was really nothing, and the rabbi said, no, he should pay back enough to get him a ticket to come to America. So I would say, and then he did say that we know that all lawyers will go to hell.
That's where that came from.
Well, no, but he used that. So he had a wonderful career and did really great things from here in Wilmington.
We're talking with Glenn Tetterton and Carol Fink, two local historians, about Jewish history in the early part of the 20th century. They are launching a lecture series in January at the Temple of Israel's Reibman Center. And we will tell you later in the show how you can register for that, get signed up for that lecture series. But if you have a question, you can ask them on this live Thursday show by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Carol Fink, you've made the point that at the early part of the 20th century, the world Jewish population was how much?
11 million people.
Not very, out of how many people?
Oh, 1 point something billion in the whole world.
Right.
Yeah. It's a time, and it was spread. It was spread. The United States still had a fairly small population, but it spread across the continents all the way to Baghdad and into India and China. There are many, many communities in Asia, of course, that no longer exist, as well as large communities in North Africa. And some of them had been awakened by European imperialism, you know, especially in North Africa. You know, the arrival of the French made a very big difference to these people. The arrival of Europeans in the Middle East, of course, made a huge difference. But yes, it was a tiny community and knew itself as such.
And how has being a minority population affected the evolution of Jewish thinking over the years? How has that shaped where the Jewish population is today? Glenn Tetterton.
I think that Jews have, over the centuries, have tried to create civilizations coexisting with other civilizations, like a Venn diagram, where there's overlap. And sometimes we've been very successful and created fruitful and marvelous institutions, and other times it's ended tragically. But in this age of increasing nationalism at the turn of the 19th century, that was becoming a problem. It was becoming more difficult. And so Carol.
Carol.
The key event for Jewish history, besides the American Revolution, where Jews immediately became citizens, was the French Revolution, where the assembly actually voted to emancipate and make Jews citizens. This was the first time in Jewish history that Jews became full citizens of the country that they lived in. And this changed everything, because this meant not only out of the ghetto, this meant the old way the Jews lived under their elders, under their laws, was going to change. Jews were going to live under national laws. But they could also serve in national and local offices. They had to serve in the army. They were Jews in the army of the French Revolution. Now, this emancipation spread only very slowly, and that was one of the problems. It didn't happen all at once. Napoleon freed the Jews all the way through to Poland and Italy, but when the French were beaten in 1815, all the old rules came back, and some of them were very harsh. Russian Jews were not emancipated till 1917, till the revolution. German Jews not till, 1871 did they become fully emancipated. And what this means is, how do you live in a country where you don't have full citizenship, where you can't, you know, where you know what kinds of restrictions you have to live under? In the case of someone like Walter Rathenau, who is a German nationalist, a very wealthy and influential man, he couldn't get a reserve officer's commission. Now, that meant a lot in Imperial Germany, because that gave you stature and power. That allowed you to go to the court, and at the court in Berlin, everything happened. So the door was open, but not completely open. Even in the United States, for example, where Jews were full citizens, there were still lots and lots of restrictions. Until very recently, in fact, major American universities had quotas on the numbers of Jews that they admitted. Till very recently, actually. There were areas, even in places we live in now, that had codicils where Jews couldn't buy property, where they couldn't buy homes. And so...
And are you talking about something that was legal or something that was just sort of kept quiet and was a tacit understanding among non-Jews?
Both.
Both. Absolutely both. Sure. And that's what it's like to live as a minority where you're, you know, in some places less than one. In Germany, Jews were, 0.5% of the population. It's thought that there were very much more of them, but that wasn't true. On the other hand, in Russia, which had the largest Jewish population at this time, they lived in the Pale. They lived in a huge ghetto where they weren't citizens, where they couldn't move, where movement was restricted, where their lives were restricted, they basically knew that they lived as servants of the Tsar.
Well, let's take this back and look at it through the lens of Wilmington. Because Wilmington, as you've acknowledged, Glenn Tetterton, has three congregations, and yet the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community have historically been fairly separate here. Is that fair to say? And it's recently...
I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay. How would you describe the growth of the Jewish community here? And it's, when you go back to what you talked about before, this Venn diagram where there's the Jewish population.
Well, you get into the issue of Southern Jewish history. And in Southern Jewish history, really the period of Reconstruction is when the Jewish community started to grow big enough here to have a congregation. And people were forming identities as Southerners and as Jews. Being white gave them some advantage over other minorities, but it didn't mean that they were fully accepted, but there were a lot of intermarriages. It's more complicated than to say that we were separate, there was a separate existence, and the Jewish community in the 19th century was largely a merchant community, and they had prominent positions in the community and in charitable organizations and men's clubs. When the temple was built, there were contributions from Christians because they were brothers in fraternal organizations. So I can't say that we were totally separate.
Carol Fink.
Yeah, one of the features of Reform Judaism is to eliminate the laws of kashrut. And that was one of the things that always kept Jews separate, that they couldn't eat with other people. And certainly, you know, and it was literally meant to keep Jews separate. Now, you know, when you have a fairly robust Jewish community here, they were socializing with other people here, and they were very much part of the community, as I understand it.
Well, yeah, in 1888, when the emperor of Germany died, there was a big memorial service at Thalian Hall, and the reporter said that the Rabbi Mendelssohn spoke in German, and he said it was a very good speech for those who could understand that language. but they were, you know, part of a community of German speakers, and there were a lot of friendships with St. Paul's Lutheran Church, for example. So it's not a totally separate existence. It was integrated in some ways, but when the Eastern European Jews came here, they had problems because their culture was different from the older, more established Jewish community here.
Just in the last decade here, there has been a growth in active outreach on the part of the Jewish community. Has there not? There are other kinds of efforts in this community to meld the two. Carol Fink.
Yeah, we see this lecture series as part of this kind of outreach. Beverly Schoninger developed the idea of a Jewish film festival, which has been extraordinarily successful. The films have been very carefully chosen to bring in Jewish history, Jewish life, and not just in the United States, but all over the world. Some people are worried about that, you know, all these foreign languages that get thrown at them. But in fact, it brings a kind of richness, not just of Jewish life and culture, but world cultures. And the point is that the Jews have always been part of the larger world.
Thinking about Louis Brandeis, the first Supreme Court justice who was Jewish, when was that and why was that such a milestone? Can you sort of... is this Glenn Tedderton?
No.
Or you want to toss it to Carol?
Okay, well, Louis
That's
Brandeis'
fine.
Family actually came from the Czech lands and came to the United States. And he was one of the people who looked at the America both with love and with the ambition to make things better. And he was a social reformer from the get-go. I mean, in his law practice, he defended unions, he defended workers, he defended the poor, and he made his name in that long before he became a Supreme Court justice. But as a justice, he went even further. I mean, some of the landmark Supreme Court decisions have his name on it, especially during the First World War.
For example, what are some of those landmark decisions?
Well, in the First World War, there were issues over conscientious objection, where the administration was pretty strong on that, and also on workers' rights, which were curtailed in wartime. No, he represents that side of Judaism, and we've got many different sides. You've brought up mysticism. We've got the ethical and legal side, but we also have the social justice side, you know, tikkun olam, make the world a better place, and he's certainly one of the leaders in that.
You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring Jewish history in the early part of the 20th century with Carol Fink, retired history professor of The Ohio State University and former faculty member of UNCW. Glenn Tedderton is a former history and German teacher at New Hanover and Ashley High Schools in the New Hanover County Public School System. And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Emma Goldman helped birth the anarchist school of thought. What led her to this way of thinking, and what role did she play in the development of that idea?
Well, she's extremely important, not only in Jewish history, but in American history. She was your sort of quintessential rebel, rebel, not only in her private life, but also in her public life. And she went in and out. I mean, if anyone has seen Red, she went in and out of the Bolshevik Revolution, first being appalled by what they had done, and then coming back and having a second look and being even more deeply appalled by it, by the authoritarianism of it. Anarchism. Anarchism, of course, is born in the late 19th century, and there are different forms of it. You know, there's the Kropotkin thing, you know, sort of thinking about one might go back to Henry David Thoreau, you know, thinking about the individual not being coerced by the state. But then there's the Bakunin and Emma Goldman form, which is, and it moved into Spain in the 1930s, of a kind of reaction against institutions and of standing for the individual. And these people were not just anti-capitalist, they were also anti-communist. They really wanted a human freedom, and freedom on all levels, freedom against coercion. And she lived this life.
What did that look like then in a concrete sense through Emma Goldman's eyes?
Her writings were very important. She mobilized all sorts of people. She inspired movements, both in the United States and in Europe. Yes.
She was shocking, too.
Yeah. Shocking how,
yes.
Glenn Tetterton.
Well, you know, she was so radical. She was expelled from the United States and had to leave. She was, you know.
On what grounds?
Her criminal behavior, but it was the kind of criminal behavior that a radical might take. She wasn't robbing banks or anything, but that she was causing trouble.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a Jewish history lesson. We're looking at the decisions made by Jewish people around the world a century ago with historians Glenn Tetterton and Carol Fink. You have one more segment to ask your question during this live Thursday show. Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today about Jewish history, how late 19th and early 20th century movements and thinkers shaped the world in which we live today. With us to answer your questions, Glenn Tetterton, former history and German teacher from the New Hanover County School System, and Carol Fink, retired history professor of The Ohio State University and the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. The two are conducting a lecture series in January at the Temple of Israel at the new Reibman Center on Market Street in Wilmington, called Tevye's Daughters, Decisions Jews Faced at the Beginning of the 20th Century. If you'd like to ask a question of our guests, you can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And before we get into Zionism and nationalism and internationalism, quickly, Glenn Tetterton, we'll say this at the end and we'll put this on our website, but if people want to sign up for this lecture series, how can they do it and what's the deadline?
Please go to the Temple of Israel's website, and we have registration information there. Our deadline is January the 5th, and we do ask for a small contribution. All the details are there.
Excellent. And as I said, we will put that on our website with this as well. Elizabeth from Wilmington called in and she asked, what are the origins of the Jewish community in Russia? Carol Fink. Small question.
Good question. Well, actually, before the 18th century, there were no Jews in Russia. They'd been all thrown out. The czars didn't want them. But then with the successive partitions of Poland, beginning in 1772, Russia became the master of this very, very large Jewish community.
And you are listening to Coastline. We're talking about Jewish history in the early part of the 20th century with Carol Fink and Glenn Tetterton. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. Aaron from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. What's your question?
Excellent. Well, I've really been enjoying your conversation. Thanks so much for having it.
Sure.
I guess I have a comment and a question. I am a 35-year-old Jewish man who lives here in North Carolina. I guess my question is, in terms of talking about the 20th century and the history and the development of Jewish thought, I wonder if you could speak to the development of Zionism and anti-Zionism. I myself am pretty much against ethnic nationalism of any kind, and that includes Zionism. And I find myself, as a Jewish man in the American community, feeling like my voice is extremely marginalized in terms of American foreign policy and in terms of the Jewish community. I feel like there are a lot of Jewish people who are really against militarism, against violence, and against ethnic nationalism, which we're seeing a resurgence of now in the United States. And I wonder if you could speak at all to the early part of the 20th century and Jewish anti-Zionist thought, especially amongst Holocaust survivors. And I guess that's it. I'm just wondering if you could speak to that issue a little bit and talk about maybe how it developed. I feel like there used to be really strong, big anti-Zionist voices in the Jewish community that got a lot of clout, and it seems like it's very marginalized now, and there's been almost a sea change, like a total shift, to the point where even saying out loud that you're against Zionism has become verboten, so to speak.
Right.
Anyway, I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much for your conversation.
Okay, Aaron, thank you so much. Carol Fink, Zionism. Before we get to the anti-Zionist movement, let's talk about Zionism in the first place for those who aren't familiar with it. How would you define it?
Well, Zionism is a fairly old idea. When Jews pray, they pray to return to Jerusalem. Modern Zionism begins in the 19th century. Actually, in the early 19th century, we have elements of it even in North Africa and North America. But the actual movement begins in 1897 with Theodor Herzl, who convenes the first Zionist Congress. Why do these people come together? They come together because, as Glenn has mentioned, in this age of nationalism where Czechs and Poles and Hungarians and all sorts of people are claiming their national sovereignty and their own state, Herzl and his followers said that the Jews cannot rely on becoming integrated into the states that they live in. Their fate must be in a state of their own, and that state must be in Palestine. Now, our caller is correct. From the very beginning, there was opposition to it. There was tremendous opposition, especially in the United States, in places where the Jews were by now very assimilated, in France, in England, and in the United States, where people said, look, I'm at home here. I'm not picking up and going somewhere else. Zionism is a threat to my identity as a Frenchman, as an American, or as an Englishman. We are at home where we are. The other thing is Zionism had many, many different expressions. There was a labor Zionism. There was an intellectual form, a kind of mystical form of Zionism that didn't necessarily have to have a state. Herzl's, though, and his followers, especially Chaim Weizmann, was a practical Zionism. And this Zionism, we're now at the 100th anniversary next year, brings up the whole issue of the Balfour Declaration, that the British took up the cause of Zionism and in November of 1917 promised the Jewish people, parentheses, in return for their support of the Allies in World War I, a homeland in Palestine. This is the charter, if you will, of the State of Israel. Again, not uncontested. Contested by British Jews, contested by the Arabs, contested by a whole lot of people. Britain took over this territory after World War I. They had a mandate there. And there were great difficulties because the Arabs, of course, the Arabs, who were the majority there by a huge amount, opposed the settlement of Jews there. The big part of this story, though, comes in 1933 with the persecution of the Jews in Germany and the huge influx of German Jews into Palestine, which causes riots and uprisings and the British effort to curtail the movement of Jews into Palestine. Why has the opposition to Zionism been stilled? Well, it's just one word, the Holocaust. 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis and their followers in Europe in World War II. And one of the reasons the Jews were unable to escape to Europe was that Britain had closed the door to Palestine and all the other doors were closed. And so even the most staunch opponents of Zionism, especially in the United States, the American Jewish Committee, for example, that had been anti-Zionist from the get-go, suddenly realized that there simply had to be a place for the refugees, the half a million Jewish Holocaust refugees, and where could they go? And this turned now into support in 1948 for the founding of the State of Israel. Now, Zionism since then has become a very complicated ideology. The UN notoriously in 1975 equated Zionism with racism.
Why? It's also been characterized as colonialism.
It is characterized as racism because in the founding of the State of Israel, Jews are given precedence to settle there and to become citizens, and non-Jews are not. A lot changed after 1967 with the Israeli conquest of the West Bank, which it still holds on to. And this is where, of course, Israel is now seen as an expansionist state, as not simply the Jewish state, but a state that lives over Jews and Arabs. The whole meaning of Zionism has greatly changed because of the history of Israel. And American Jews, European Jews, Russian Jews, Jews all over the world have a complicated relationship to Israel.
As Aaron was expressing just a few minutes ago,
sure.
And he says he finds it hard to understand that worldview at this point, and he feels marginalized by his own community for that.
Well, you know, the part of Zionism that says that, you know, Jews deserve a state like other people is uncontestable. Well, maybe not to some people, but Israel, you know, was recognized by the world in 1948. It's in the United, although there are those people who would like to annihilate the state of Israel. That part of Zionism to most people in this world seems to be acceptable.
How has Amos Oz, the Israeli writer, shaped the way we think about Zionism today?
Well, he stands as one of the foremost critics of his state since 1967. I mean, he's fought in all the wars, as have his children and grandchildren. But he is uncomfortable, as many Israelis are, with Israel as an occupying power and with its difficult relationship with its Arab neighbors. And again, you get a repeat of what happened in Europe. Are we going to live together? Are we going to have a binational state? Can we merge Jews and Arabs? Or do we have to live as separate people? And then how would that work out? Once in the late 19th century, they thought that the Habsburg monarchy might work in this way. You know, as a state that had about 14 different nationalities ruled by an emperor. It was an idea, but it collapsed in 1918 into nation states. And that seems, unfortunately, to be our model. The problem with these nation states is that they're never pure. There will always be minorities. There will always be people who are not part of the dominant group. And how do we deal with them?
Glenn Tennerton.
I'd like to go back a little bit to opposition to Zionism. One of the big opponents of the Zionist movement were the Bundists, who were the Jewish labor movement, and the Yiddishists, who instead of Hebrew being the Jewish language, they wanted to retain and nurture the Yiddish language. And they were quite a large number of people in Eastern Europe, but most of them were destroyed, killed by the Holocaust. So that strain of Judaism still exists. Or of Jewish life still exists, but it's been overwhelmed by history.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Jewish history in the early part of the 20th century. We have Carol Fink and Glenn Tennerton, two local historians, who are here for just a few more minutes. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Deborah from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to kind of discuss briefly. I'm an attorney at TAM and have been for probably 25 years. And just in, well, let's just be blunt, since the election, I have had more than one Jewish parent contact me to discuss the horrible anti-Semitic bullying that their children are facing in our local school system.
Deborah, are you now, talking about this most recent election?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. These are extremely recent events. Now, I'm quick to say that the school system has strongly and swiftly dealt with these incidents. But again, in 25 years of practice, I've never had such a thing. And I'm just wondering how the panelists feel about this. You know, there has to be a connection to
what seems like a reemergence of anti-Semitism.
Oh, my God.
Right here.
You know, it's terrifying. And, you know, it's not directed, I'm sure, at our Jewish community, but anybody who is in the minority. But I'd like to hear them discuss that in the context of our current political environment.
Thank you so much for your call, Deborah. Carol Fink.
Well, we saw in the recent campaign very clear anti-Semitic references.
And you're talking specifically about a post made by the Trump campaign that had a Star of David next to
an image of Hillary Clinton. There was also
and of course the campaign,
the final ad that named six Jewish people. Blank Fine and Green, the Jewish bankers and financiers who controlled the world. But there are also people who are very sensitive to anti-Semitic tropes who thought that Crooked Hillary sounded very much like old forms of anti-Semitism. You know, that old idea that the Jews rig the system. The Jews bore within the system and they rig the system. And this was constant. Now, the bullying that's going on, not only against Jews, but against Muslims, against blacks, you know, this is very serious and this is nationwide right now.
Well, we've watched the rise of populism in the European Union. The New York Times recently, I think it was earlier this week, wrote about a Harvard researcher, I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly, Yasha Monk, I think, whose work suggests that liberal democracies around the world may be at serious risk of decline. He developed this set of indices. It's sort of like a test. And it correctly established Venezuela as one of those countries before Hugo Chavez came into power. He published a book in 2014, Stranger in My Own Country. He started out with a memoir of his experiences growing up as a Jewish person in Germany, but it became this broader investigation of how contemporary European nations were struggling to construct these new multicultural national identities. And he concludes, basically, the effort isn't going very well. He's kind of pessimistic about this. Carol Fink, you went to Israel in 2014, around the same time he was putting this book together, and you were part of a conference looking at issues around, what, the populism? This was right after the election of Netanyahu.
That's right.
And Netanyahu had said some pretty controversial things.
He had said very controversial things. He had said he had accused the Arabs of mounting buses, you know, and coming in with great busloads and corrupting the election. He'd also gone to the West Bank and promised that, you know, not one inch of land was going to be left. And it was a pretty heavily populist right-wing campaign, and the results showed it. The results were in many ways as shocking because the pollsters, again, were completely gobsmacked by it. The thought was that there was going to be a coalition government. In fact, the right wing won very strongly. Now, when law breaks down, minorities are in trouble. I think this is one of the things we're going to talk about in our lectures.
And we're going to have to leave it there. That's this edition of Coastline. Carol Fink and Glenn Tedderton, such a pleasure having you with us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show is engineered by Caleb Covington. Join us next Wednesday for a look at sea level rise through the eyes of a planner and scientist. And on Thursday, it's the extraordinary story behind the assistance dog nonprofit Paws for People. That's Wednesday and Thursday at noon. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes Store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.